de have. Miss Ellen North, he said, hunching up his shoulders as the wind bit a little harder and spit a sweep of fine white snow across the parking lot. You already have. Chapter 3. The Fontaine Hotel sat kitty-corner from the city center on the opposite side of the park that made up the old-fashioned town square. In ordinary times, Ellen would have enjoyed a brisk walk around the park, ending in the warmth of the Fontaine's beautiful restored Victorian lobby. But these were not ordinary times. She parked her car in the lot beside the hotel and sat with a heater and fan running full blast, as if the trembling in her arms and legs had anything to do with the cold. She liked to think of herself as strong, smart, savvy, able to handle herself in any situation. In a matter of moments, in the course of a few sentences, a lone man had managed to summarily unnerve her. Without ever laying a hand on her, without ever making a verbal threat, he had shown her just how vulnerable she really was. J. Butler Brooks. She had seen his face on the cover of People as she'd stood in the checkout line at the supermarket. She had seen his name on book covers, remembered glancing through an article about him in a recent issue of Newsweek. He was one of the current pack of lawyers-turned-authors. But instead of making his fame with courtroom fiction, Brooks had chosen to capitalize on actual crime. His books sold millions, and Hollywood snapped them up like Godiva chocolates. The story had left a bad taste in Ellen's mouth. She looked at the business of turning true crimes into entertainment as twisted and sleazy. Vulgar voyeurism that only helped blur the lines between reality and fantasy, and further inured Americans to violence. But money talked, and it talked big. J. Butler Brooks was worth more than most third world countries. I prefer to catch people off balance. The remembered timbre of his voice rippled through her. Dark, warm, husky, seductive. The word whispered through her mind against her will, against logic. He had said nothing seductive. There had been nothing sexual about the encounter. Still, the word hung in her mind like a shadow. Seductive. Dangerous. If I wanted to harm you, I would be smart enough to follow you home. Reporters came out of the mahogany woodwork the instant she set foot in the Fontaine's elegant lobby. Ellen shouldered her way past them without comment and breathed a sigh of relief at the sight of a uniformed police officer guarding the doors to the elevator. He nodded to her as she stepped into the car and halted those who would have followed her, demanding that they produce room keys. As a number of them scrambled to reach into their pockets, the doors closed. Wright's wife had been given a room on the second floor to discourage any notions of flinging herself out a window. The woman who answered the door to room 214 was not Karen Wright. Teresa McGuire's pixie face peeked out from behind the safety chain, eyes narrowed with suspicion, mouth tightened into a knot. The victim witness coordinator for Park County, she had drawn babysitting detail because there were no women on either the Deer Lake or Park County forces. "Ellen, thank God," she whispered, closing the door enough to slide the chain free. "I thought you were Paige Price. Would you believe yesterday she actually thought she could talk her way past me just because she once interviewed a friend of mine for a story on victims' rights? That bitch! I wouldn't watch Channel 7 if you held a gun to my head." "I hear she's been reassigned to cover that sewage plant disaster in Minot, North Dakota," Ellen said softly, setting her briefcase on a side table. She blew it big time getting into bed with a sheriff for her inside information. A shudder of revulsion jiggled through Teresa's small, plump body. "That is so gross! Paige Price and Russ Steiger! Anybody in Russ Steiger! Do you think he ever changes the oil in that hair?"
"I try not to wonder. How's Mrs. Wright holding up?"
Teresa shot a look toward the bedroom that was separated from the entrance by a partial wall. "She's not, poor thing. She keeps saying it has to be a mistake. She's been sedated. I don't know how much good she'll be to you." Ellen shrugged out of her coat and hung it in the closet. "We have to keep trying to get through to her. She could be the key to this whole thing."
Karen Wright sat in a flowered chintz chair, staring at the print that hung in an ornate gilt frame above the bed, a mother cat watching her plump, fluffy kittens cavort with a ball of yarn. She had curled herself into the chair, pulling her feet up onto the seat and wrapping her arms around her knees, a variation on the fetal position. She was a lovely woman with delicate features and ash-blonde hair that hung like silk in a classic bob. The only sign that she had spent the past several days in tears was the red that rimmed her big doe eyes and tinted the end of her upturned nose. Somehow the color managed to coordinate with the rose-colored leggings and soft gray sweater she wore. "Karen, I'm Ellen North with the county attorney's office." Ellen pulled out the chair from the writing desk and sat. "I'd like to talk with you for a few minutes, if that's all right."
"It was a mistake," Karen said,
without looking away from the print.
"Garrett's never even had a parking ticket."
"We have a good deal of evidence against him, Karen," Ellen said gently. "By law, you can't be compelled to testify against your husband. But if you know anything at all that could be helpful in finding Josh, you would tell us, wouldn't you?" Karen nibbled at a cuticle and dodged Ellen's gaze. "Do you know any reason he would single out the Kirkwoods? Any reason he would take Josh?" The silence stretched into a moment. Two. "This must be especially hard for you. You must feel betrayed. Maybe even guilty, in a way." The feelings had to be there somewhere, deep inside. She had been stuffing missing child flyers into envelopes at the Josh Kirkwood Volunteer Center, had gone to the Kirkwoods' house to babysit Josh's little sister, while her husband had been holding them all in the grip of fear. Had he fooled her that completely? Or had she known all along? "Karen, you have to be aware that you could be considered an accessory," Ellen said. "People are having a hard time believing you didn't know what Garrett was doing." Not a flicker of response. Karen combed a strand of hair behind her ear. Slowly, a smile spread across her mouth.
"Lily's so sweet," she murmured. "I don't mind watching her. Garrett and I don't have any children."
Tears glittered in her big dark eyes.
"I suppose Hannah won't let me watch her anymore."
She put her head down on her knees and sobbed softly, as if the prospect of not being able to babysit was too much for her, but the idea that her husband was some kind of sociopathic monster made no impact on her whatsoever. Ellen didn't know whether to feel sympathy or horror. Frustration took up the slack. "Karen, you have to listen to me." Leaning forward, she reached out and took a firm hold of the woman's wrist. "Josh is still out there somewhere. If you have any idea where Garrett may have taken him, you have to tell us. Think of Hannah and Lily. Think how much they must miss Josh."
"And Paul,"
Karen murmured, lifting her head a fraction, her gaze fixed on the fringed lamp that sat on the night table.
"He has such a nice family,"
she said wistfully. "Yes, Josh has a very nice family, and they miss him very much. You have to help them if you can, Karen. Please." Ellen held her breath as she watched the play of emotions in Karen Wright's eyes. Confusion, pain, fear. Was she afraid of her husband? Had he somehow brainwashed her? He was a professor of psychology. He had to know how to manipulate minds. "He can't hurt you, Karen. It can only help everyone for you to tell us what you know." Karen slowly pulled her arm from Ellen's grasp and unfolded herself from the chintz chair. Hugging herself, she wandered the room, ending up in front of the antique ash dresser, staring at her own reflection in the oval mirror above it. Slowly, she picked up a brush and started in on her hair with gentle strokes.
"A terrible mistake," she whispered. "Garrett would never... he wouldn't do that to me."
Ellen pushed herself to her feet and headed for the door. "I'll leave you my card, Karen," she said, placing it on the dresser as she passed. "You can call any time of the day or night, any time you think of something that might be helpful, or if you just want to talk."
"No, it's just a mistake,"
Karen mumbled to herself, stroking the brush through her hair. He watched Ellen North emerge from the Fontaine Hotel, wondered what she'd got. Karen was there, being watched by 100 eyes. He wanted to go to her, talk to her, but that wasn't possible. She would never betray him. He consoled himself with that thought, even as fear rose inside him like a tide of acid. Life had betrayed him again and again, tricked him into thinking he wanted one thing when he needed something else. The job, the house, the car, the trophy bride. Every time he grabbed a prize, he found he wanted something else. The hunger never abated. It simply changed its guise. He wanted someone to blame for that, but he could never see where the blame should lie. When he was younger, he had blamed his parents. His father, a man who settled for less than his family deserved. And his mother, a woman who stood in her husband's shadow. Lately, he had thrown the blame at Hannah's feet. Her career came first, before her family, before him. She had never been any man's shadow. Her shadow fell across him, and he hated her for it. Ironically, no one else blamed Hannah for anything. Throughout this ordeal, they had painted her as a victim, as a valiant figure struggling to cope. Poor Hannah, the mother whose child had been taken. Poor Hannah. She helped so many people. She didn't deserve all this pain. Poor Hannah, who had left their son standing outside the skating rink while she'd tended to someone else's needs at the hospital. Poor Hannah, who'd sat at home waiting for the phone to ring while he had gone out and beat the bushes with the search teams and made pleas on television. No one ever said, "Poor Paul." Thanks to that BCA bitch, O'Malley, they had turned to him with suspicious eyes because of that damned van. They had tried to tie him to Ole Swain, had tried to blame everything on him when he had done everything he could to play the hero. A victim. That was what he really was. A victim of circumstance. A victim of fate. He didn't even have a home to go to tonight. "I don't know who you are anymore, but I know I'm sick of your lies and your accusations. I'm sick of you blaming me for losing Josh, when all you seem to want to do is bury him and hope the cameras get your good side at the funeral. I don't have to listen to this." He looked away from her, away from the contempt in her eyes. "No," Hannah said, picking up his coat off the back of the sofa. She flung it at him, her mouth trembling with fury and with the effort to hold the tears at bay. "You don't have to listen to me anymore, and I don't have to put up with your moods and your wounded male ego and your stupid petty jealousy. I'm through with it. I'm through with you. You don't live here anymore, Paul." The scene played through his mind. Saturday night. Mitch Holt had come to give them the news of Garrett Wright's arrest. Hannah would divorce him, and everyone would look at her and say, "Poor Hannah." No one would look at what had been taken from him. No one would say, "Poor Paul." Except Karen. No one understood him except Karen. A yawn pulled at Ellen's mouth, and she gave into it, stretching, rustling the thick down comforter that covered her legs, and drawing a one-eyed look from the big golden retriever sprawled across the foot of her bed. "I know it's late, Harry," Ellen said, shoving her reading glasses up on her nose. She resettled herself against the mountain of pillows and among the piles of law books and fought off another yawn. The cube-shaped clock radio on the cherry bedside stand pronounced it to be 12:25 a.m. "I'm working to put away the guy who took Josh." The dog whined a little, as if he, too, had absorbed the hours of news coverage about the abduction. Ellen let Minnesota rules of court, state and federal, fall shut in her lap, as an image of Garrett Wright rose in her mind, the image he had given her in the interview room, pale, drawn, delicate, a victim, not a monster. Although there were people ready to pin the blame for these crimes on anyone, there were a great many people in Deer Lake who would not want to pin the blame on Garrett Wright, people who had trusted him, respected him, looked up to him, the students from Harris, the people who backed the juvenile offenders program he had helped establish. There would be people who wouldn't want to believe, because if a man like Garrett Wright could be guilty of something so ugly, then who could they trust? Who can you trust? The question brought a chill with it, a memory of old cynicism and hard-won wisdom. Trust no one. She didn't want to believe that anymore. She had done her time on cases of smoke and mirrors, where nothing was as it seemed, where enemies came with smiles and stroked with one hand while the other plunged the knife in deep. "Long ago and far away," she murmured, magic words to ward off the memories. She could see Wright, against a dark background, staring at her with eyes that were bottomless black holes, soulless, staring into her, through her. The corners of his mouth turned up in a smile that made her blood run cold. He knew something she didn't. The game plan, the big picture. He looked inside her and laughed at something she couldn't see. Then his image blurred into another.
Frighten you, Miss North? You don't strike me as the sort of woman who would be easily frightened.
He stepped closer, leaned closer. She tried to back away and found herself held to the spot, unable to move. She could feel the energy around him. Seductive. The word wrapped itself around her like curling fingers of smoke.
Assumptions can be very dangerous things.
Ellen jerked awake with a cry that brought Harry's head up. Her heart was pounding, her glasses askew. She pulled them off and set them aside with a trembling hand as she tried to jump-start her brain. A sound. A sound had snapped her to consciousness. A bang or a thump. She wasn't sure. Holding her breath, she strained to listen. Nothing. But in the back of her mind, that dark voice whispered,
"If I were after you, I would follow you home. Find a way to slip into your house or garage. Catch you where there would be little chance of witnesses or interference."
The killer blue eyes stared up at her from the pages of the Newsweek she had dug out of the recycling bin. She picked up the magazine and glared at his image. It was an artsy shot full of shadows. He stared at the camera, looking tough, his hands curled around the bars of a wrought iron fence. His hair was brown, cropped short with a hint of cowlick in front. His face was masculine, angular, with a slim straight nose and a stubborn chin. In contrast, his mouth was full, sculpted, almost feminine, far too sexy. The kind of mouth that hinted at dark, sensual, secret talents. The headline read, "Crime Boss," in bold black letters. The caption, "Crime Pays Big Time for J. Butler Brooks." Ellen scowled at the photograph. "I should have had you arrested." Disgusted with herself, she tossed the magazine aside and crawled out from under the covers and the books. Trying to ignore the uneasiness that curled through her midsection, she picked up the half-empty glass of white wine from the table and padded barefoot across the plush, ivory carpet. Her doors were locked. Her alarm system was on the bed, watching her. Sipping absently at the wine, she pulled aside the thick swag of ivory lace at the window and looked out at the night. The new snow sparkled like a carpet of white diamonds beneath the light of a crescent moon. Beautiful. Peaceful. No hint of the storm that had slapped Minnesota over the weekend. No evidence of the violence that had put Megan O'Malley in the hospital. No sign of Josh Kirkwood. Just another quiet night in the Lakeside subdivision. The Kirkwoods neighborhood. Garrett Wright's neighborhood. Her house was less than two blocks away from theirs. She could see a wedge of lake from her living room, was within walking distance of Quarry Hills Park, where Mitch and Megan and Garrett Wright had played out a life-and-death drama Saturday night. Ellen had been sitting in front of her fireplace, sharing cappuccino and conversation with a friend, oblivious to what was happening a stone's throw from her own home. Harry raised his head abruptly, a growl rumbling low in his throat. The dog jumped down off the bed and stood at attention at the door that led into the darkened hall. Ellen stood in the center of the room, pulse rate jumping, trying to recall in detail the actual act of locking the doors. She had come in from the garage into the kitchen. She always locked the deadbolt as she came in for the night. It was habit. She had gone out the front door for the mail, come back in, turned that deadbolt as her gaze scanned the words, "You may have already won $10 million. The doors were locked. There were no odd sounds emanating from the nether regions of the living room. With that knowledge bolstering her courage, she stepped past the dog and into the hall. Harry gave a little whine of embarrassment and trailed after her, bumping up against her legs as she paused on the short flight of steps that led down to the living room. Faint silver light filtered in around the edges of the blinds. The comfortable sofas and chairs were indistinct hulks in the dark. Nothing moved. No one spoke. Beneath the warm flannel of her pajamas, Ellen's skin pebbled with goosebumps. The fine hairs on the back of her neck rose as another low growl rumbled in Harry's throat. The telephone trilled its high-pitched bird call. The sound ripped through the room like a shotgun blast. Harry galumphed in a clumsy circle, his booming bark all but rattling the framed photographs on the walls. The phone rang again. The last call she had got in the middle of the night had been Mitch telling her Ole Swain was dead. Maybe Wright had been struck down with remorse and killed himself too. But she doubted it. She had told Karen Wright to call any time of day or night. Maybe Wright's wife had found her way out of the fog of denial. "Ellen North," she answered, her voice automatically taking on the same tone she used at the office. Silence. "Hello?" The silence seemed to grow thicker, heavier with expectation. "Karen, is that you?" No response. The caller remained on the line, silent, waiting. Another minute ticked past on the nightstand clock. "Karen, if it's you, don't be afraid to talk to me. I'm here to listen." Still nothing, except the creepy certainty that someone was on the other end of the line. The hope that that someone was Karen Wright evaporated. Ellen waited as another minute slipped past. "Look," she said crisply, "if you're not even going to bother to talk dirty to me, hang up and free the line for someone who knows how to make an obscene phone call." Not a sound. Ellen slammed the receiver down, telling herself it was a tactical move rather than nerves, a lie that was made painfully clear by the way she jumped as the phone rang again. She stared at it as it rang a second and third time, then gave herself a mental kick and picked it up. "Ellen North." "Ellen, it's Mitch. Josh is home." Journal entry. January 25th, 1994. "They think they have us. Guilty as sin. Caught in the act. Dead to rights. Dead wrong." Chapter 4. "Josh, did the man hurt you?" Josh didn't answer. He looked away at the poster on the wall instead. The poster was of a man on a gray horse jumping a fence. It was bright and colorful. Josh thought he might like to ride a horse like that someday. He closed his eyes and pretended to dream he was riding the gray horse on the moon. Dr. Robert Ulrich bit back a sigh, flicked a glance at Mitch, then turned to Hannah. "I can't find any signs that he's been sexually abused." Hannah stood beside the examination table where Josh sat wearing a thin blueprint cotton gown. He looked so small, so defenseless. The harsh fluorescent lighting gave his skin a ghostly pallor. She kept one hand on his arm to reassure him. And herself. A doctor herself, she knew better than to interfere with the proceedings, but she couldn't bring herself to sit in the chair, 3 feet away. She hadn't broken contact with him since she had opened the front door of the house and found him standing on the step 2 hours ago. She had been trying to sleep, something she didn't do very well anymore. The bed seemed too big, the house too quiet, too empty. She had told Paul to leave Saturday night, but he had been lost to her long before that. The happy partnership they had once shared seemed a distant memory. Lately, all they had between them was tension and bitterness. The man she had married 10 years ago had been sweet and gentle, full of hope and enthusiasm. The man she had faced 2 nights ago was angry and petty and jealous, discontented and emotionally abusive. She didn't know him anymore. She didn't want to. And so she had lain alone in their big bed, staring up at the skylight and the black swatch of January night, wondering what she would do. How would she cope? Who would she be? That was a big question. Who would she be? She certainly wasn't the same woman she had been 2 weeks before. She felt like a stranger to herself. The only thing clear was that she would cope, somehow. She had to, for herself and for Lily. And for Josh. For the day he came home. Then there he was, standing on the front step. Afraid the spell might break, she hadn't let go of him since that moment. Her fingers stroked the soft skin of her son's forearm, assuring her he was real and alive. "Hannah, are you listening to me?" She blinked, and focused on Bob Ulrich's square face. He was closer to 50 than 40. He had been a friend to her from the day she had come to interview for a staff position at Deer Lake Community Hospital. He had been influential in the board's recent decision to name her head of the ER. He had delivered Lily and removed Josh's tonsils. He had come to the hospital tonight at her request to examine Josh. He looked at her now with concern.
"Yes," Hannah said. "I'm sorry, Bob."
"Do you want to sit? You look a little woozy."
"No."
Mitch contradicted her without saying a word, sliding a stool up behind her and pressing her onto it with a hand on her shoulder. Her blue eyes were glassy, her hair a mass of golden waves hastily tied back. The past week had taken a toll on her physically. Naturally slender, she now looked thin to the point of anorexia. She had stood beside the table for the entire exam, holding Josh's hand, staring at his face, leaning over to kiss his forehead. She didn't seem to be aware of the tears streaming down her cheeks. Mitch pulled a clean handkerchief out of his hip pocket, pressed it into her free hand, and wondered where the hell Paul was. He should have been here for this. For Josh. For Hannah. Hannah had tried to call him at his office, which was where he had been spending his nights, and had got his machine. Mitch had sent a squad car to the office complex. Nearly 2 hours later, there was still no sign of Paul. And God knew, tomorrow, when Paul would be the center of attention for the press, he would blame the police department for not rushing him to his son's side. Josh had been absolutely silent throughout the whole ordeal, not uttering a sound of fear or discomfort. He answered no questions. Mitch hoped the last would be a temporary condition. This was already a case with too many questions and not enough answers. While Josh's reappearance was cause for celebration, it added to the Q column. With Garrett Wright sitting in a jail cell, who had brought Josh home? Did Wright have an accomplice? What few clues they had pointed to Ole Swain. Ole had audited some of Wright's classes at Harris. Ole had the van that fit the witness description. But the van had yielded them nothing, and Ole Swain was dead. "There's no sign of penetration," Dr. Ulrich said quietly, keeping one eye on Josh, who seemed to be asleep, sitting up. "No redness, no tearing." "We'll see what the slides show," Mitch said. "I'm guessing they'll be clean." The doctor had conducted the standard rape kit, searching Josh literally from head to toe for any sign of a sexual assault. Oral and rectal swabs taken would be tested for seminal fluid. Mitch had overseen the exam as a matter of duty, watching like a hawk to be certain Ulrich didn't skip anything, well aware the doctor had little in the way of practical experience with this kind of procedure. Just another of the challenges of law enforcement outside the realm of a city, where rape was not an uncommon crime. Deer Lake Community Hospital didn't even own a Woods lamp, a fluorescent lamp used to scan the skin surface for signs of seminal fluid. Not that a Woods lamp would have done them much good in Josh's case. The boy appeared scrubbed clean, and the scent of soap and shampoo clung to him. Any evidence they may have got had literally gone down a drain. "What about his arm? You think they drugged him?" "There's certainly been a needle in that vein," Ulrich said, gently pulling Josh's left arm toward him for a second look at the fine marks and faint bruising on the skin of his inner elbow. "We'll have to wait for the lab results on the blood tests."
"They took blood," Hannah murmured, stroking a hand over her son's tousled sandy brown curls. "I told you, Mitch. I saw it."
He gave her a poker face that told her he was politely refraining from comment. He probably thought she'd finally cracked. She couldn't blame him. She had never put much stock in the ravings of people who claimed they saw things in dreams. If she had been asked to diagnose a woman in her own situation, she would have probably said the stress was too much, that her mind was trying to compensate. But she knew in her heart what she had seen in that dream Friday night. Josh standing alone, thinking of her, wearing a pair of striped pajamas she had never seen before. The same striped pajamas he had been wearing tonight, which Mitch Holt had bagged to send to the BCA lab. Mitch leaned down to Josh's eye level.
Josh, can you tell me if someone took blood from your arm?
Eyes closed, Josh turned to his mother, reaching for her. Hannah slid off the stool and gathered him close.
He's exhausted, she said impatiently, and cold. Why is it so damn cold in this hospital?
You're right, Hannah.
Ulrich said calmly. It's after 2. We've done all we need to for tonight. Let's get you and Josh settled into a room. Hannah's head came up as alarm flooded through her.
You're keeping him here?
I think it's wisest, considering the circumstances. For observation, he added, trying to take the edge off her panic. Someone is watching Lily, right?
Well, yes, but
Josh has been through a lot. Let's just keep an eye on him for a day or so. All right, Dr. Garrison? He added the last bit to remind her who she was, Hannah thought. Dr. Hannah Garrison knew how things were done. She knew what logic dictated. She knew how to keep her composure and her objectivity. She was strong and level-headed, cool under fire. But she had ceased to be Dr. Hannah Garrison. Now she was Josh's mom, terrified of what her child must have gone through, sick at heart, racked by guilt. How's that sound, Josh? Ulrich asked. You get to sleep in one of those cool, electric hospital beds with the remote controls, and your mom will be right there in the room with you. What do you think about that? Josh pushed his face into his mother's shoulder and hugged her tighter. He didn't want to think at all. Ellen paced the confines of the waiting room like an expectant aunt. Marty Wilhelm, the agent the BCA had sent down from St. Paul to replace Megan, sat on the couch, flicking through cable channels with the remote, seemingly mesmerized by the changing colors and images. He looked young and stupid. Tom Hanks, without the brain. Too cute, with a short nose and a mop of curly brown hair. Ellen had taken an instant dislike to him, then chastised herself for it. It wasn't Wilhelm's fault that Paige Price had decided to play dirty and turn the media's attentions on Megan and Mitch's budding relationship. Nor was it Marty's fault Megan had a hot Irish temper and a tongue that was too sharp and too quick for prudence. That Megan had become a public relations problem, which had outweighed her value as a cop, had nothing to do with Marty. All those issues considered, she still disliked him. He glanced up at her with eyes as brown and vacuous as a spaniel's and said for the 9th time, "It's taking them long enough." She gave him the same look she had given thick-headed boys in high school and kept on pacing. The only other person in the waiting area, Father Tom McCoy, rose from a square armchair that was too low for him and stretched a kink out of his back. Having grown up Episcopalian, Ellen knew him only in passing and by reputation. Barry Fitzgerald, he was not. Tom McCoy was tall and handsome, with an athlete's build and kind blue eyes behind a pair of gold-rimmed glasses. He had come to the hospital wearing faded blue jeans and a flannel shirt that gave him more resemblance to a lumberjack than a priest. He gave Ellen a questioning look as he fished some change out of his pocket.
Coffee?
No, thanks, Father. I've had too much already.
Me too, he admitted. What I really need is a drink, but I don't think the cafeteria has a machine that dispenses good Irish whiskey.
As McCoy walked away, Wilhelm cocked his head.
He's not like any priest I ever knew. Where's his collar?
Ellen gave him the look again. Father Tom is a nonconformist.
So I gathered. What did you think of his deacon, Albert Fletcher?
I didn't know Albert Fletcher. Obviously, he was a very disturbed individual. Fletcher had fallen under suspicion regarding the kidnapping because of his ties to Josh through the church, as Josh's instructor for religion class, and as an altar boy. Obsessed with the church, Fletcher had crossed the line from zealot to madman, unnoticed until he'd attacked Father Tom and Hannah early Friday morning as they'd sat talking in St. Alicia's Catholic Church. He had given Father Tom a concussion with a brass candlestick. Later that morning, the mummified remains of Fletcher's long-dead wife had been discovered in his garage. The incident had sparked a manhunt that had ended in tragedy during Saturday evening Mass, where Fletcher, ranting and wild-eyed, had fallen to his death from the balcony railing. Whether or not there would be further investigation into Doris Fletcher's demise had yet to be determined. So much that was bad had happened in so little time. Kidnapping, suicide, madness, scandal. It seemed as if a hidden seam in the fabric of life had given way, allowing evil to pour into Deer Lake from some dark underworld. And if they didn't figure out how to close it up, it would continue on, poisoning everything and everyone it touched. The thought gave Ellen a chill. The hospital was quiet, the halls dimly lit. Word of Josh's return had gone out on a need-to-know basis. What staff was on duty at this time of night hovered around the main desk, talking in low tones and casting worried glances down the hall toward the examination room Hannah and Josh had disappeared into with Mitch and Dr. Ulrich. Reaching for the can of warm soda she had set on an end table, Ellen froze mid-gesture as the examination room door swung open and Mitch emerged. She hustled to meet him. "Did he name right?" she asked. Crossing his arms over his chest, Mitch propped a shoulder against the wall. "He didn't name anybody. He isn't talking."
"At all?"
"Not a word." Ellen's sinking feeling was the sure-thing conviction sliding away. An instinctive response that had nothing to do with her sense of compassion. They were separate entities, the lawyer in her and the woman. The lawyer thought in terms of evidence. The woman thought about a small boy who had been through God only knew what hell in the past 2 weeks. "How is he?"
"Physically, he seems pretty good. No signs of sexual abuse."
"Thank God."
"He may have been drugged or had blood taken from him. His blood had to get on that sheet some way, and he had no injuries to speak of. We'll know more when the lab results are in."
"We'll know what?" Wilhelm demanded, rushing up, his proper paisley necktie flipped over his shoulder. Mitch frowned at him.
"We'll meet in my office at 7, and I'll go over it all with both of you."
"What about questioning the boy?" Wilhelm blurted, looking as if he had come all the way to the North Pole, only to find out Santa wouldn't grant him an audience.
"It'll wait."
"But the mother..."
"Is an emotional wreck," Mitch snapped. "She didn't see anyone, didn't see a car. All she knows is she has her little boy back. You can talk to her in the morning."
Wilhelm's dark eyes shone bright with temper, even though his trademark boyish grin still stretched across his face.
"Now, look, Chief, you can't shut me out of this. I have the power..."
"You don't have jack shit here, Marty," Mitch said. "Do you understand me? I don't care if the BCA sent you down here with a golden crown and scepter. You try to push me on this, and I'll squash you like a bug. Nobody sees Hannah or Josh until they've had some rest. But..."
Marty's protest was cut off as the emergency room doors to the street swept back, and Paul Kirkwood stormed into the lobby with a pair of uniformed officers at his heels. His brown hair was wind-blown back from his lean, angular face. Cold and excitement rouged his cheeks, his deep-set eyes fixed on Mitch as he strode down the hallway.
"I want to see my son!"
"Hannah and Josh are being settled in a room."
"Hannah?"
he said peevishly.
"What's wrong with her?"
"Nothing having Josh back won't cure. She's just a little rattled, that's all."
"And what about me? You think I'm not rattled?"
"I don't know what you are, Paul," Mitch said wearily. "Other than late, that is. Where the hell have you been?"
His gaze strayed to the officers who stood behind Josh's father.
"We caught him coming back to his office, Chief."
"Caught me? Am I under arrest here?"
Paul's voice was sharp with indignation.
"Should I be calling my attorney?"
"Of course not, Mr. Kirkwood."
Ellen intervened, trying to break the mounting tension between the men. "We wanted to make you aware Josh had been returned, that's all. We also thought you might want to be with your son during the physical examination."
"I was out driving around."
Paul's mouth turned in a petulant curve.
"I haven't been having a lot of success sleeping lately.
How is Josh? What did that animal do to him?
He's fine, Mitch said, then amended the overstatement for the sake of his conscience. He seems fine, physically. I'll walk with you to his room, fill you in.
As they started down the hall, Wilhelm started after them. Ellen snagged him by the shirt sleeve and held him back. The BCA agent wheeled on her.
I'd like to hear a better explanation of where he was tonight.
So would I. We'll hear it in the morning.
What if he's involved? What if he's the one who took Josh home? He could skip.
Don't be stupid, Ellen said impatiently. If he wanted to skip, do you think he would drop off the son he kidnapped, then drive around town for 2 hours, then go back to his office, then run?
Wilhelm wagged a finger in her face.
He owned that van.
That van that yielded us nothing.
I think we should take Mr. Kirkwood downtown and discuss his whereabouts tonight.
Then you feel free to express that opinion to Chief Holt. Push him far enough, and you'll be able to question Dr. Ulrich while he tries to set the broken bones in your face. Personally, I've seen enough of this hospital for one night.
Wright's bond hearing was less than 8 hours away. Garrett Wright, who would be charged with the abduction of Josh Kirkwood. Josh Kirkwood, who had been returned home safe, while Garrett Wright sat in a cell in the city jail. Hannah refused the offer of a patient's gown to sleep in. She ignored the cot that had been set up for her next to Josh's bed. She pulled her boots off and climbed onto the bed with her son. Josh played with a control switch, slowly raising and lowering the head of the bed, the foot of the bed, bending it in two in the middle. The ride was not unlike the one Hannah's emotions had been on for the past 2 weeks, the ride they were still on now. The idea that Josh was back safe was a giddy high. The fear of what had been done to him mentally was a crashing black low. The feelings chased each other around inside her, around and around, up and down, as the bed went up and down. She slipped her arm around Josh and settled her hand over the control.
That's enough, sweetheart. You're making me seasick, she murmured.
She smiled softly as one of his sandy brown curls tickled her nose.
Remember the time we went out on Grandpa's boat and Uncle Tim got seasick after he teased us about being landlubbers?
She waited for him to roll over and grin at her, eyes bright, giggles bubbling just behind his smile. He would laugh and tell her the whole story, complete with sound effects, and she would feel the most incredible swelling, brilliant, warm rush of love and relief and joy. But he didn't roll over, and he didn't laugh. He didn't move. He didn't speak. He just went still. The rush of love was an ache. The joy was tangled in anguish. The door swung open, and Paul stepped into the room looking anxious and hesitant at once. Hannah bit down on the questions she wanted to snap at him. Where had he been? Why hadn't he been here for Josh? How like him to leave the worst moments for her to deal with, then walk in after the fact? And what a sad commentary on their relationship, that in this moment that should have been so happy for them both, the first thing she wanted to do was attack him. He rushed into the room, his gaze fixed on their son.
Oh, God!
He whispered, struggling visibly with a knot of emotions, disbelief, joy, uncertainty.
Josh!
Josh sat up and stared at him, unsmiling.
I tried to call you, Hannah said softly. I tried your office.
I was out, Paul said shortly, not taking his eyes off his son. He mustered a smile, reaching out slowly.
Josh, son!
Josh hurled the bed control at him and flung himself at Hannah.
Josh! Hannah cried.
Her expression of surprise was directed at Paul.
Josh, it's me, Dad,
Paul said, confusion furrowing his brow. He sat on the edge of the bed, reaching out again to touch his son's shoulder. The gesture was battered away. Josh's legs kicked out as if he were trying to run.
I don't understand this, Paul said. Josh, what's the matter? Don't you know me?
His only answer was a frightened squeal as Paul tried once more to turn Josh toward him. The boy surged against Hannah, pushing her backward.
Paul, don't try to touch him, she snapped. Can't you see you're only making it worse?
But I haven't done anything. Paul stepped back from the bed just the same. "He's my son, for God's sake! I want to see him!"
"No!"
Josh's shout was muffled against his mother's body.
"No, no, no!"
"Hush, sweetheart," Hannah murmured against the top of his head. Panic rose inside her. "What's going on in here?" Dr. Ulrich demanded as he strode in from the hall.
"I wish I knew,"
Paul muttered.
"What did you do that upset him?"
"Nothing, he's my son." Ulrich raised a hand.
"Just calm down, Paul. I'm not accusing you of anything," he said quietly, turning his back to Josh and Hannah, working his way between them and Paul. "But I think it would be a good idea if you go now and come back in the morning, after Josh has had some time to rest and get his bearings."
"You're throwing me out?" Paul yelled, incredulous. "I don't believe this. After everything I've done to try to get my son back, after everything I've gone through..."
"This isn't about you, Paul," Ulrich said,
his voice low. "I'm sure this is upsetting to you, but you know we have to put Josh first. We have to realize it's going to take some time to sort out what happened to him and how he feels about it. Let's you and I go down to the cafeteria and have a talk."
Paul knew a brush off when he heard one. Ulrich was slowly backing him toward the door, away from Josh and Hannah, shutting him out. Wasn't that the story of his life? Everything went to Hannah, the glory, the pity, their son.
"Jesus, Hannah," he said, "you could help a little here."
"What am I supposed to do?"
She looked at him as if he were a stranger, someone to be wary of, someone to keep at bay. Anger burned inside him. "Some support would be nice."
"No, no,"
Josh mumbled, kicking at the covers. Dr. Ulrich took another step.
"Come on, Paul. Why don't you go down to the cafeteria and get a cup of coffee? I'll join you in a few minutes and fill you in on the examination."
"He doesn't have any reason to be afraid of me."
"Paul, for God's sake, please," Hannah pleaded.
"Fine," he muttered. "Hell of a homecoming."
Tom McCoy watched from down the hall as Paul Kirkwood stormed into and out of his son's hospital room. His training dictated he try to intervene and smooth things over between family members. His training didn't apply anymore. Not here. Not between Hannah and Paul. He had tried. Paul resented his attempts, considered it interference rather than help. In the process, Tom's feelings toward Paul had become something less than Christian. It was difficult for him to find understanding in his heart for a man who had married a jewel and treated her like dirt. Paul Kirkwood had so much, and was so blind to it. 2 beautiful children, a comfortable home, a stable career. Hannah. Therein lay the heart of the problem. Hannah. Glad for the shadows in the hall, Tom leaned back against the wall and stared up at heaven. He couldn't see it, of course. There was too much in the way, physically and metaphorically. Hannah had turned to him, the one person she thought she could trust absolutely, her priest. And her priest had committed a cardinal sin. He couldn't for the life of him admit that what he had done was wrong. He hadn't broken any vows. He had kept silent. Locked tight in his heart was the fact that he had fallen in love with Hannah Garrison.
"I could use a little help here, Lord," he murmured. But as he looked up, all he could see was a faint brown stain in the ceiling where a water pipe had once sprung a leak. With a weary sigh, he walked down the hall to Josh's room and cracked the door open a few inches. A lamp on the far side of the bed washed the room in a soft topaz. Josh lay curled on his side, with his thumb in his mouth, asleep. Hannah lay behind him, his small body tucked back against hers, her arm around him. She looked like an angel who had tumbled to earth, tendrils of wavy golden hair escaping their band to fall against her cheek. The picture brought a bittersweet ache. He started to turn away from it, then Hannah opened her eyes and looked right at him. And he could no more walk away than he could stop his heart from beating.
I just wanted to check on you two before I left, he whispered, slipping into the room. It looks like Josh is out cold.
The wonders of modern sedatives, Hannah murmured, raising herself on her elbow. How are you doing?
I've got Josh back. That's all that matters.
Paul didn't stay.
Careful not to disturb Josh, she sat up and tucked her legs beneath her. Josh didn't want him here. He acted as if he were afraid.
The words had the bitter taste of blasphemy, as if she were somehow betraying Paul by speaking them, even though they were nothing less than the truth.
God, I hate Garrett Wright for what he's done to us, she admitted. He did more than take our child. Whatever problems Paul and I had before all this, at least we trusted each other. When Josh reacted to him tonight, I looked at Paul like I'd never seen him before, like I actually believed he could have...
I don't, she whispered, even as the doubts scrolled through her mind. The lies about the van, the times he had been gone, his answering machine at the office picking up when he should have been there.
Father Tom sat on the edge of the bed, reaching out to take her hand. She grabbed hold and hung on tighter than she meant to, wishing with all her heart he would put his arms around her and just hold her for a while. The longing that rose in her soul was for comfort and friendship and compassion. Things Tom McCoy would offer freely with no strings attached. He would never suspect her feelings had grown deeper. She would never tell him. She wouldn't risk losing what they had by asking for more than he could give her.
Don't add more guilt to the burden, Hannah, he said softly.
She jerked her head up and looked at him, her pulse quickening at the absurd idea that he had somehow read her thoughts.
You can't control a reaction like that. Who knows why Josh reacted badly to his father? He's frightened and confused. We don't know what he's been through. We don't know what Wright might have planted in his mind. Josh responded, and you reacted to that. You're allowed. You're his mother.
And Paul is his father. He would no more hurt Josh than he would
hurt me.
Which he had done again and again. Hurt her in ways that didn't leave obvious bruises or scars.
He wouldn't hurt Josh.
I'm sure he wouldn't. Tom raised his other hand and brushed a stray tear from beneath her eye. His fingertips threaded into the golden silk of her hair, and she turned her face to rest her cheek against the cool of his palm for just a moment. She held her breath, as if she could hold the moment within it.
Get some sleep, he whispered, fighting the urge to lean down and press a kiss to her forehead or her lips.
Her hand was still in his. He gave it a squeeze. She answered it back.
We'll talk tomorrow.
Thanks for coming tonight. You've gone above and beyond the call through all of this.
No, he said. You deserve a lot more than what you've been given.
And he wished like hell he could have been the man to give it to her. But he couldn't be, or so he was told. And so he turned and walked away. And Hannah lay back down beside her child, listening to the rhythm of his breathing and wishing for things that could never be.
Chapter 5.
There was no way of containing the news that Josh Kirkwood had been returned. The hospital staff told friends, who told other friends who worked nights and stopped into the Big Steer truck stop out on the interstate for coffee and pie. The Big Steer served as restaurant to the Super 8 Motel, where 4 out of 5 rooms were occupied by reporters. They were lying in wait, like a pack of wolves, when Ellen pulled into the city center lot at 5 to 7. She promised to give them something later and hurried into the building, hanging a left into the law enforcement center. They met in a conference room that had been dubbed the War Room in the first hours of the investigation into Josh's kidnapping. A timeline was taped to one long wall to keep track of everything that had happened pertaining to the case. From a fat red main artery, numerous tributaries branched out in various colors of ink. The notes that had been left by the kidnapper to taunt them were emblazoned across a white melamine message board in Mitch Holt's bold, slanted handwriting. A large cork bulletin board was covered with a map of Minnesota
and one of the 5-county area. The maps were bristling with pins that marked search areas. Ellen poured herself a cup of coffee and took a seat at the table next to Cameron. Wilhelm sat across from her, nursing the same lack of sleep hangover she was fighting. Sheriff Steiger had claimed a chair at the head of the table, a minor power play in an ongoing pissing contest with Mitch. Steiger was 50, lean and tough, with a narrow face and a complexion like old leather. Adhesive tape across his nose suggested he had lost a battle in the war for supremacy. The looks the two traded were stony. As much as she disliked Steiger for the sexist jerk he was, Ellen took no pleasure in the seething enmity between the two men. A successful investigation, an investigation that would lead to a conviction, required teamwork and open lines of communication between all team members. Mitch paced along the timeline as he filled them in on Josh's exam and what had transpired later in Josh's room. "So Paul Kirkwood is still a suspect," Wilhelm declared. "Suspect is too strong a word," Mitch said. "Josh's reaction could have been caused by any number of reasons other than guilt on Paul's part. It could have been that Paul shares some physical characteristics with Wright, or maybe it was the way Paul approached him, or something in the tone of his voice." "We have to tread lightly here," Ellen cautioned. "Mr. Kirkwood is already hypersensitive to the attention he's gotten. He feels victimized by the crime and by the police. If we mishandle this and he's completely innocent, we're going to be looking at lawsuits." "I'm seeing him this morning," Mitch said. "I'll be the soul of diplomacy." "I want in on that," Wilhelm said. "Any progress on finding the location Wright held Megan?" Ellen asked. "We know it wasn't his own house," Wilhelm said, trying unsuccessfully to stifle a yawn. "We know it wasn't Christopher Priest's house, even though the initial attack took place in Priest's yard. Wright drove her somewhere." "We're doing a record search in a 50-mile radius," Steiger interjected, "trying to find out if Wright owns any other property in the area."
"He could own it under another name, or under a dummy business name," Cameron suggested bleakly. "Or the house could belong to his accomplice, whoever that might be."
"Well, we know now it couldn't have been Ole Swain," Mitch said. "And Karen Wright was locked up tight in the Fontaine last night." Wilhelm raised his eyebrows.
"But Paul Kirkwood was out driving around town in the middle of the night."
"Maybe we should be looking for connections between Kirkwood and Wright," Cameron said, uncapping a fountain pen and jotting a note on his legal pad.
Mitch looked unhappy at the suggestion. "What motive could cause Paul to conspire with Garrett Wright to steal his own son? That's just fucking bizarre."
"World's full of perverts and kooks, Holt," Steiger commented, chewing on a toothpick. "You ought to know that."
The tension in the room thickened, like the air before a lightning strike.
"What about that student of Wright's?" Ellen prompted, steering the conversation back on track. "Todd Childs?"
"We're checking him out, too," Steiger grumbled. "Goddamn pothead."
"And Priest?"
"Him, too."
"Priest passed a polygraph," Mitch reminded them. "He was in St. Peter Saturday. We've confirmed he spent the night in a motel because of the storm. It looks like Wright sent Megan to Priest's place, knowing the professor wouldn't be home. The isolated location made it the perfect spot for an attack."
"What about the third professor involved with the sci-fi cowboys?" Cameron asked.
"Phil Pickard," Mitch said. "He's on a year-long sabbatical in France."
"Wright claims he was working in the Cray building at Harris at the time Josh was abducted," Ellen said. "If we could find someone who saw him leave the building before Josh was taken."
"Trouble is, there was hardly anyone on campus because of winter break," Mitch said. "And there's the possibility that the accomplice picked Josh up. Wright may well have been right where he says he was."
"Agent Wilhelm, I'm assuming you've got someone digging into Wright's past," Ellen said. He nodded and rubbed his eyes like a sleepy child.
"And we can hope to hear from the evidence techs as soon as they find anything in the stuff they confiscated from Wright's home?"
"Yes."
Ellen checked her watch and rose, fighting off a yawn herself.
"I want to be the first to know."
"What about Stovich?"
Steiger scowled at the prospect of having to report to a mere woman, or a second-in-command, or both. She looked him square in the eye. "This is my case, Sheriff. Report to me," she said, snapping the latches on her briefcase. "Thanks, gentlemen. We're out of here. We've got a bond hearing to prepare for." The pack had grown to a mob. Ellen made them follow her all the way to the courthouse and gave them their soundbite on the front steps, with the grand facade of justice looming up behind her. "We're overjoyed at Josh's return. This is the conclusion everyone was praying for." "How will this affect the prosecution's case against Garrett Wright?" "Not at all. The evidence against Dr. Wright is more than sufficient. All this shows is that he wasn't acting alone, a suspicion we harbored all along." "Is Josh talking? Did he identify Wright?" Ellen gave them a ghost of a smile. "We're very confident about our case." She turned and walked away from them, with Cameron falling in step beside her. They pushed through the main doors and turned up the steps to the second floor. The reporters didn't hesitate to follow, storming into the building like a human tornado, all noise and motion. Ellen couldn't help but think about what Brooks had said to her about the lack of security. "This is a highly volatile case you've got here. Anything might happen." She made a mental note to talk to Rudy about it. There was no sense taking unnecessary risks. She kept her poise as the reporters' questions filled up the cavernous hallway and resounded off the high ceiling, drowning out the noise of the third-floor renovations. She let them draw their own conclusions from her cool silence, let them think she had this case in her pocket, when those same questions rattled around inside her like a pair of dice. Would Josh pick Wright out of a photo lineup? Would they get him to talk about what had happened? Or had he been so traumatized he would lock the secrets inside his mind forever? "You're a cool one, Ms. North," Cameron said with a smile as they entered the sanctuary of the outer office. Ellen gave him a wry look. "Never let him see you sweat, Mr. Reed." She breathed a sigh of relief. This was her turf, her second home, this warren of scarred wooden desks and ancient filing cabinets that smelled of 3-in-1 oil. Portraits of county attorneys past hung high on the dingy beige walls that were waiting for the renovators. Bulletin boards sported notices and dictates from higher offices and court-related cartoons. Telephones rang ceaselessly, ignored by the people arriving for work in favor of unwrapping the layers of outerwear from their bodies. Someone had started the first pot of coffee. Phoebe, by the exotic scent of it. The secretary who served as Ellen's assistant shunned the ordinary in most respects, a tendency immediately obvious in her choice of clothes. The standard office look for Phoebe was Holly Hobby meets Buddy Holly. Cotton peasant dresses with Doc Marten shoes and black-rimmed nerd glasses. Somehow Phoebe managed to make the look work. Rudy had raised his eyebrows at her more than once, but her work was exemplary, and Ellen was her staunchest advocate. "What's our treat this morning?" she asked, grabbing her mug off the shelf above the pot.
"Cinnamon praline," Phoebe said,
her voice muffled by the thick, llama-wool poncho she was struggling out from under. She emerged with her long, kinky hair, a wild black cloud around her head. A tiny, breastless thing, she had dressed in filmy layers today, a tunic the color of eggplant, over a skirt the color of dirt, over a pair of black tights with army boots. She tossed the poncho over her chair, her brown eyes bright with excitement, and fixed on Ellen.
"Is it true? Is Josh back?"
"He showed up at home around midnight."
"That's so great," she said,
tears of joy welling up. Her emotions never ran far from the surface. Only the sheer weight of the boots kept her feet on the floor.
"Is he all right?"
Ellen weighed her words as she warmed her hands with her coffee mug and let the scent of cinnamon tease her nose. "All right might be a stretch, but he seems in good shape physically."
"Poor little kid."
Phoebe dug a tissue from somewhere among the layers of her outfit and rubbed it under her reddening nose.
"Imagine how scared he must have been."
"It could have been worse," Ellen said. "It could have been unspeakable." Other cases from other places went through her mind as she let herself into her office.
horrible tales of bodies found in pieces cast into drainage ditches, or discarded in the woods like so much garbage for scavengers to feed on. They were so very lucky to have Josh back, talking or not. Not even the lingering feeling that it was all part of Wright's twisted game could dampen Ellen's sense of relief. She tried to hit her office light switch with an elbow, missed, and moved on. Setting her briefcase on the floor beside her desk, she took a sip from her coffee and reached to set the mug on the cork coaster beside her blotter. The mug hit a neat stack of reports.